Chapter 12. Now that the weekend was over, Rod found the apartment oppressive, and he longed to get out of it. He shaved, standing naked before the mirror, and he caught a whiff of the reeking ashtrays and half-empty glasses in the lounge. The char would have her customary Monday morning greeting when she came in later today. From Louis Boothe Avenue, the traffic noise was starting to build up, and he glanced at his watch. 6 o'clock in the morning. A good time to examine your soul, he decided, and leaned forward to watch his own eyes in the mirror. You're too old for this type of living, he told himself seriously. You've had 4 years of it now, 4 years since the divorce, and that's about enough. It would be nice now to go to bed with the same woman on 2 consecutive nights. He rinsed his razor and turned on the taps in the shower cabinet. Might even be able to afford it if our boy Manfred delivers the goods. Rod had not allowed himself to believe too implicitly in Manfred Steiner's promise. But during the whole of these last 2 days, the excitement had been there, beneath the cynicism. He stepped into the shower and soaped himself, and then turned the cold tap full on. Gasping, he shut it off and reached for his towel. Still drying himself, he went through and stood at the foot of the bed. As he toweled himself, he examined the girl who lay among the tousled sheets. She was tanned dark toffee brown, so she appeared to be dressed in white transparent bra and panties, where the skin was untouched by the sun. Her hair was a blonde gold flurry across her face and the pillow, at odds with the jet black triangle of body hair. Her lips in sleep were fixed in a soft pink pout, and she looked disquietingly young. Rod had to make a conscious effort to remember her name. She was not the companion with whom he had begun the weekend. "Lucille," he said, sitting down beside her, "wake up. Time to roll." She opened her eyes. "Good morning," he said, and kissed her gently. She blinked. "What time is it? I don't want to get fired." 6, he told her. "Oh, good. Plenty of time." And she rolled over and snuggled down into the sheets. "Like hell." He slapped her bottom lightly. "Move, girl. Can you cook?"
"No." She lifted her head. "What's your name again?" she asked.
"Rod," he told her.
"That's right. Piston Rod," she giggled. "What a way to die. Are you sure you aren't powered by steam?"
"How old are you?" he asked.
19. How old are you?"
38.
"Daddy, you're vintage," she told him vehemently.
"Yes, sometimes I feel that way." He stood up. "Let's go."
"You go. I'll lock up when I leave."
"No sale," he said. The last one he had left in the flat had cleaned it out. Groceries, liquor, glasses, towels, even the ashtrays. 5 minutes to dress." Fortunately, she lived on his way. She directed him to a run-down block of flats under the mine dumps at Booz Ends.
"I'm putting 3 blind sisters through school. You want to help?" she asked as he parked the Maserati.
"Sure." And he eased a 5-rand note out of his wallet and handed it to her.
"Tara Muchley."
And she slipped out of the red leather seat, closed the door, and walked away. She did not look back before she disappeared into the block. And Rod felt an unaccountable wave of loneliness wash over him. It was so intense that he sat quiescent for a full minute before he could throw it off. Then he hit the gears and screeched away from the curb. "My little 5-rand friend," he said, "she really cares." He drove fast, so that as he topped the Kral Kop Ridge, the shadows were still long, and the dew lay silver on the grass. He pulled the Maserati into a lay-by and climbed out. Leaning against the bonnet, he lit a cigarette, grimacing at the taste, and looked down at the valley. There was no natural surface indication of the immense treasure house that lay below. It was like any other of the countless grassy plains of the Transvaal. In the centre stood the town of Kitchenerville, which for half a century had rejoiced in the fact that Lord Kitchener had camped one night here in pursuit of the wily boar. A collection of 3 dozen buildings, which had expanded miraculously into 3,000, around a magnificent town hall and shopping complex. Dressed in public lawns and gardens, wide trees and bright new houses, all of it paid for by the mining houses, whose lease areas converged on the town. Out of the bleak veldt surrounding the town, their headgears stood like colossal monuments to the gold hunger of man. Around the headgears clustered the plants and workshops. There were 14 headgears in the valley. The field was divided into 5 lease areas, following the original farm titles, and was mined by 5 separate companies: Thornfontein Gold Mining, Blauberg Gold Mining, West Tweefontein Mining, Deep Gold Levels, and the Sonderditch Gold Mining Company. It was to this last that Rod naturally directed his attention. "You beauty," he whispered. For in his eyes, the mountainous dumps of blue rock beside the shafts were truly beautiful. The complex but carefully thought-out pattern of the works buildings, even the sulphur-yellow acres of the Slimes Dam, had a functional beauty. "Get it for me, Manfred," he spoke aloud. "I want it. I want it badly." On the 28 square miles of the Sonderditch's property lived 14,000 human beings. 12,000 of them were Bantu, who had been recruited from all over southern Africa. They lived in the multi-storied hostels near the shaft heads, and each day they went down through 2 small holes in the ground, to depths that were scarcely credible, and they came up again out of those same 2 holes. 12,000 men down, 12,000 up. That was not all. Out of those same 2 holes came 10,000 tons of rock daily, and down them went timber and tools and piping and explosive, ton upon ton of material and equipment. It was an undertaking that must evoke pride in the men who accomplished it. Rod glanced at his watch. 7:35 a.m. They were down already, all 12,000 of them. They had started going down at 3:30 that morning, and now it was accomplished. The shift was in. The Sonderditch was breaking rock and bringing the stuff out. Rod grinned happily. His loneliness and depression of an hour ago were gone, swallowed up in the immensity of his involvement. He watched the massive wheels of the headgear spinning, stopping briefly, and then spinning again. Each of those shafts had cost 50 million rand, the surface plant and works another 50 million. The Sonderditch represented an investment of 150 million rand, $220 million. It was big, and it would be his. Rod flicked away the butt of his cigarette. As he drove down the ridge, his eyes moved eastward down the valley. All mining activity ceased abruptly along an imaginary north-south line, drawn arbitrarily across the open grassland. There was no surface indication why this should be so, but the reason was deep down. On that line ran a geological freak, a dike a wall of hard serpentine rock that had been named the Big Dipper. It cut through the field like an axe stroke, and beyond it was bad ground. The Gold Reef existed in the bad ground, they knew this, but not one of the five companies had gone after it. They had prospected it tentatively and then shied away from it, for the boreholes that they sank were frightening in their inconsistency. A big percentage of the Sonder Ditch lease area lay on the far side of the Dipper, and there was a diamond drilling team working there now. They had already completed five holes. Rod could remember accurately the results. Borehole SD number 1, abandon in water at 4,000 feet. Borehole SD number 2, abandoned in dry hole at 5,250 feet. Borehole SD number 3, intersected carbon leader reef at 6,600 feet. Assay valve, 27,323 inch pennyweights. First deflection, 6,212 inch pennyweights. Second deflection, 2,114 inch pennyweights. Borehole SD number 4, abandoned in artesian water at 3,500 feet. Borehole SD number 5, intersected carbon leader at 8,116 feet. Assay valve, 562 inch pennyweights. And they were drilling the deflections on that one now. The problem was to build up a picture from results like that. It looked like a mess of faulted and waterlogged ground, with the Gold Reef fragmented and fluky, showing unbelievably high values at one spot, and then more than likely pinching out 50 feet away. They may mine it one day, thought Rod, but I hope to hell I'm on pension by the time they do. In the distance, beyond the Slimes Dam, he could just make out the spidery triangle of the drilling rig against the grown grass. "Go to it, boys," he muttered. "Whatever you find there won't make much difference to me." And he went in through the imposing gates at the entrance to the mine property, halting carefully at the stop sign where the railway line crossed the road, and he forked two fingers at the traffic policeman lurking behind the gates. The traffic cop grimmed and waved. He had caught Rod the previous week, so he was still one up. Rod drove down to his office.